This is Katie.
And this is Sarah.
We're two friends who are kind of obsessed
with a little of this
and a lot of that
and everything in between.
Welcome back to Kind of Obsessed.
Hey, Katie.
Hey, Sarah. What's up?
Just a little Friday sheltering in place kind of situation. How you doing?
I too am sheltering in place. Not much has changed, although the weather lately has been absolutely beautiful, which is nice.
It is actually super stunning here in New York City. Unfortunately, I have not been able to partake for a few days.
I know you haven't been feeling well. What's wrong? Well, and then you had a crazy, you have to tell them what happened to you this morning.
I'm mortified to tell anybody this.
You it's have to tell.
I will, but so I sadly have had my very first migraine of my whole life, started on a couple of days ago, everybody, it's Friday, and started on Wednesday. And so Wednesday and Thursday, I was sort of out of commish. And then I slept like a rock star last night, all through the night, woke up at 7:15, which is amazing. I normally wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning, full speed ahead. And I was thinking about how I was going to kick today's ass and all the stuff I was excited to accomplish that I've sort of missed out on the past couple of days. And I went to go take some migraine medicine. And instead of doing that, Katie, I took 2 Z-Quills. So I have had more caffeine today than a human person should. And I
can't believe you're still awake right now.
It's so hard to talk about because at once it's the most mortifying thing that I've ever done, and two, I'm like so frustrated that the day that I feel better, I now am like such a moron, and I can't really like.
I wonder if God is telling you something like you need to rest more.
Did you say God?
Yeah, God. G-D. I can't spell his name.
It's a tough one. Well, I'm drinking wine, which I normally would during a podcast, but I'm drinking it because I need to level out all the caffeine that is in me that's working against the Z-Quil. And so, but anyway, yeah. So, but I shockingly, my head feels good. So that's all good. I am just, I'm super psyched about today. And I'm super psyched about just being with you.
I know. So I'm really excited that we started doing these IG Live sessions.
Oh my God. How much fun have they been?
Yeah. Every Thursday we've started to come together on Instagram Live just to chat and update everybody on what we're up to and tell them about our upcoming episode, which usually drops on Fridays. So it's been super fun because I don't know. Like part of me feels like I'm just like in a bar hanging out with you, you know, but then we have like this audience of people who, you know, put in their comments and their questions and, you know, we have a couple glasses of wine and hang out. It's really fun.
It's so nice to be interactive, you know, number one, it's always great to see you. Like literally I can't stress enough, especially during this time. It's so great to see your face and, you know, your kids will pop up and, into the room and it's just super fun, but it's just like a time for us to be together and just shoot the shit, but also to really interact with, you know, the folks who are cuckoo for coup.
Coup being kind of obsessed.
But you guys should come and join us every Thursday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, because we know you guys are all over the world. But join us on Kind of Obsessed. Yes.
We need to talk about for a second, like all of your singing going on.
Oh God.
On your Instagram page. I did not know. You are like just like an endless little ball of talent.
Wow.
Like you meet you and you're like, okay, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. But then you like just bust out all these talents like singing, acting, comedy.
Modeling.
Modeling, exactly. Modeling. Well, that's a new career for you though.
That is absolutely.
That kicked off last week.
100% new.
Yeah.
Well, thanks.
How did you start doing that?
I've always enjoyed singing growing up. I used to sing at every family gathering, like that annoying precocious kid that you literally wanted to sit on the other, maybe in another town, really, not even on the other end of the room. But it started with, if anybody knows this, I would be so excited. Really Rosie. Do you know Really Rosie? Mm-hmm. It's a Maurice Sendak book. So Where the Wild Things Are, and Carole King wrote the book. I wrote the lyrics and the music. Sure. And so Chicken Soup with Rice, Pierre, it's about this New York City girl who lives on Avenue B, and she wears a boa, and she's probably 8 years old, and she is a diva. And she.
Oh, yeah. This sounds really familiar.
This was literally my entire childhood. I didn't grow up on Avenue B, but I grew up on Lexington Avenue and 90th Street, and I used to put on these things all the time. And so that was sort of the genesis of it. So I loved always performing and singing specifically. But during this pandemic, I don't know. Like, the first
Star
song
is born.
The first song that I sang was really, was one of my father's favorite songs. And I was finding that both my parents were just going outside way too much and involving themselves in the general public. And I was like, stay home. And I had tried everything I felt to get them to stop. And so I thought, oh, let me sing this sweet song and maybe my dad will like it and it'll make him stay home. What?
Aw, that's so sweet though.
Yeah, whatever.
Did it work?
No. Nope, not even a little bit. Although
I was like, oh, I gotta get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, seriously, he went running in the opposite direction. But anyway, it's just been, and I just posted it as a total, like, just make yourself vulnerable, which is another thing I'm trying to do this year in 2020. And I posted it probably at 10:30 at night. And that was sort of the start of it. And, you know, it's been.
Well,
it's
I think you're fantastic. And I mean, you're really a talented singer, and you picked some great songs too. What's been your favorite so far?
I think my favorite was the first one, which was, it was a cover of a Bob Dylan song, To Make You
I
Feel
love Bob Dylan. I'm a huge Bob Dylan fan.
I am not, but that the really? Music oh, and lyrics of that song, I just love. And it's just, I think it's just a beautiful song, but I mean, I've done, you know, Little Big Town, Girl Crush. I've done a James Morrison song, who's a British singer. I forget the name of the song.
So what does this turn into, like, after we're all done sheltering in place? Like, are you going to...
No. Nothing.
You going to hit the clubs?
Yeah, no.
The jazz clubs?
It is. Yeah, the jazz clubs. Oh, God. No, but it's just been, like, just a fun way to create during this. Like, yeah. I wouldn't know how to, as you know, I've done stand up before, but I wouldn't, that hasn't really been like inspiring my quarantine. Like, I haven't, not that I'm not feeling funny and I have no sense of humor, but it's like, I'm not like a joker, you know, like it's not really like that. And I don't even know what possessed me to sing this song. And I only sing them if I like, you know, want to. It's not like, you know, people are requesting them. Let's put it that way.
Well, maybe we could start.
Yeah. Well, go ahead.
Well, other than singing, what are you kind of obsessed with right now?
Great question. Didn't expect this one.
Didn't expect it at all. I didn't think I was going to ask it.
But as small business owners, I am a huge advocate of shopping.
Oh, wow. That is...
And supporting small businesses. So one of my amazing teachers from my studio shared with us that she was buying these candles, and she showed a picture and they just looked beautiful in her home. And so I went and looked them up, and the company is California, Southern California, LA based, and it's called Rowen, R-O-E-N. Mm-hmm. And I bought 3 candles from them, and they are so beautiful, but specifically they have like a California line. And one candle that I bought is called Mulholland, which specifically, again, my dad keeps popping up, but he loves the movie Mulholland Drive. Anytime he would visit me, we would always have to go drive on Mulholland Drive. And I bought one, that is called Marmont, which is from the Chateau. And it's one of my favorite hotels in the entire world. It always makes me feel like I am not in Southern California, but I'm in the south of France or someplace. And this candle smells like it literally takes me back. And not only are they beautiful candles with amazing scents, but they are so, the the personal touch. Like they sent me a little card and were like, "Hi, Sarah. Really hope you enjoy these candles. Thank you so much."
I love that.
It was so nice and like handwritten. And that is the beauty of a small business. And so now my apartment, without even lighting them, smells amazing. And it totally, it's very much like sense memory. So I'm completely transported to Los Angeles and like the best parts of Los Angeles that I love.
Right. So. Not the Hollywood Boulevard.
Not the shady parts where I had to, you know, sell my body for money.
Wow. Okay. So maybe we should talk about that.
No, did not. I mean, honestly, I mean, yes, as we all knew, I struggled when I was there, but that would not have helped. Let's be 100%. Oh,
you'd be a wealthy woman now if you had done that.
Oh, Katie, you rue me.
I know. That's awesome. It's always good to find a good candle. I mean, I have to say, there's a lot of candles out there. There's a lot of good candles, but the way it smells, I feel like, is a really key part of it. And if they can nail that and it can actually like smell good and like fill a whole room, you know, it's amazing how much we're willing to spend on candles too. Sometimes I'm like, I mean, some of these candles are like $60 or more. By the way, side note, did you know that Gwyneth Paltrow for Goop has a candle that's called Smells Like My Vagina, and it's like always sold out?
Stop it. I can't. Number one.
I swear to God, go look it up.
I know it exists. My girlfriend bought it for her sister for her birthday.
That's what I'm saying. Like it's sold out. I think they charge like $60-something for it.
At least. And also not a small business. So suck it, Goop. That's all I have to say. But I will tell you, in defense or in support of Rowan, I have had a migraine, as I said, and I received these candles when I had a migraine, and it like scents normally will trigger a headache for me. Not at all. Like it's amazing. I can't. And I'm imagining that these candles are what my vagina smells like. So that's what I'm going with. My vagina smells like.
You can totally go with that. Yeah.
Chateau Marmont. That's what my vagina
100%.
Smells.
I think the whole world would agree with you on that. No. On that note, we have a great interview coming up.
Wait! Has the whole world?
The whole
smelled my vagina?
World.
Oh my word.
I mean, I don't know. I'm just guessing. Why don't you tell everybody about our guest today, like real quick?
All I have to say is that we are going to be introducing everybody in the coup world to two amazing women, both writers and very accomplished in their own right, but one who went the way of CIA and FBI and the other who went the way of novelist and comedic writer, and both super badass. I can't wait to introduce you guys to them.
Yeah, it's a pretty incredible, unique story that, I mean, the more I read about it, I was like, what? It seems made for TV or made for a movie. So
Katie, you may have your psychic powers on today.
Let's get into the interview.
Let's do it.
All right.
Okay, guys, we are so excited. We have not one, but two amazingly accomplished guests today. Our first is Tracy Walder, whose recently published memoir, The Unexpected Spy, chronicles how she went from a USC sorority house to the CIA and the FBI. Foreign operatives even referred to her as Malibu Barbie. I've oft been referred to as such, and her book's co-author, the gorgeous Jessica Anya Blau. Jessica has written several comically biting novels that I have read and has also taught writing at the prestigious Johns Hopkins University, amongst others. We're incredibly proud to have them both here today and to find out about how their paths crossed and more about their fascinating, ready-for-TV, literally camera-ready lives. You guys, thank you so much. Tracy is already laughing. So we've got her. We've won her over. Jessica's got a huge smile on her face. How are you guys?
Great.
Good. Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us. I love your podcast. I listen. I subscribed.
Thank you.
Excuse me. Compliment. Well, I'm done now. Thank you. Katie, why don't you please take it from here?
I guess my most burning question is, how does someone go from being a sorority girl to being a CIA agent, which is essentially what you did? I know.
Why not? I guess.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, that's an excellent.
I became interested when I saw Peter Bergen and Peter Arnett's interview with Osama bin Laden back in like 1997, I believe it was. They were interviewing this dude in a cave somewhere, and I was watching CNN at that time. And I thought, you know, who is this? Like, what is this? And I think I had, in college, I had sort of, I went to college to be a high school history teacher. Mm-hmm. And that's what I always wanted to be. But I think as the college years wore on and I was exposed to friends and like different professors, I started wondering if there were like different applications for my degree. So I interned at a museum, I interned in the Senate, like I kind of just tried to experience different things that I could do with my degree. And the CIA was one thing I could do with my degree. So I applied.
So how did you get hooked up with the CIA initially? Like, what was that? Did you just apply for the job, like wrote them a letter and said...
No, I had gone to the college I went to at USC has, like most colleges have like a main thoroughfare, like a main kind of like quad area. Mm-hmm. And they set up all their career fairs there and still do, they told me. And there at that time, there were just a bunch of different companies like that day hiring. And so I had gone with my roommate and there was a table that said CIA. And I had asked the guy, you know, I'm a history major, like, can I work here? And, you know, he had said yes. And so I gave him my resume. That was it.
I mean, is that like something I can go to the USC quad right now and just be like, hey, I'm 46. Can I apply to be in the CIA? I can't imagine anything cooler or more fascinating. Like, what an interesting thing to go. Like, I would imagine that most history majors would end up opening a history store, but you went, right?
That's been my dream.
Obviously, as one does.
Yeah, as one does. What was your first experience with them like? And what is the application like? Actually, let's start.
I'm curious, like, how does one get into the CIA? Because as Sarah and I are realizing, like, you know, when you're a small business owner in like the COVID-19 pandemic, like we're really starting to explore other career opportunities. And I mean, why not? Like you said, why not the CIA at this point?
I say, yeah, go for it.
Thank you. Thank you,
Chase. I was super young. So I was like 20, I think, when I had first given it. I was a junior. So I was like 20. And so there's like all these different hoops you have to go through. And you can, the CIA does regularly recruit on a lot of college campuses. That's not like an unusual thing, I guess. But the process takes like steps. So like my first one was an interview, and then you pass that, and then you go... they fly you out to the East Coast for like psychological testing, a medical test, polygraph, and then you pass that. And then they do your background check. And then if you pass that, then they give you the offer of employment. So it's like steps.
And once you got in, what did you do? What was your job?
So I first started working in the Counterterrorism Center, but I was looking at terrorist training camps, mapping.
And this was right, you got in right before 9/11, is that right?
Yeah, it was like May of 2000, so like 14 months before 9/11.
And how did it change in terms of being an agent in the CIA? How did your experience change from pre-9/11 to post-9/11?
So pre-9/11, like, you know, we have to remember like back in my day in college, like terrorism wasn't a thing. You know, we didn't, mm-hmm. it just wasn't.
Yeah, it was more like, AIDS was like the killer.
Yeah, AIDS.
No, seriousness. No, it was. I mean, that was what everybody had, you know.
Yeah, no, I got it.
It was AIDS. A lot of people were doing like Latin American narcotics stuff. Oh, right. Like, I mean, there was like, that kind of was what was going on. And so in counterterrorism, I don't want to say it was like slow, but it was very stable, right? So it's like you work your 9-to-5 like shift, right? And you go home, and like I had a thing where I would work 12-hour days instead of 8-hour days, so I could get one day off like every other week. It was awesome, so I could travel. You know, it was just stable, I guess.
That's why I always thought about counterterrorism too. Yeah, like
super safe
facility. Yeah, safe. Yeah.
But like back at that time, like it wasn't where things were like happening. Yeah. And so obviously once September 11th happened, it was not stable anymore. You know, you're working all hours of the day. You don't have days off, you know.
But wait, can I step in here? So Tracy's like totally amazing and heroic and like the most badass person, but she will not brag. And so it's like, so it's like, oh my God, you know, I'm sitting here thinking you have to tell the, you know, so she just, and that's her nature. But you think about somebody who's in the CIA, like they could never tell anyone what they did. It's like she saved so many lives and she can never tell anyone how or where. So if I can just jump in about September 11th, which is, Tracy, do you mind if I jump in a little?
Okay. This is why I work well with you.
Just because she just won't. She's so used to not telling anyone about anything great she does. It's like it's all in her head. Like it doesn't even, you know. So it's like before September 11th, she was selected. She was one of just a handful of people who were selected to be in the program, which was the armed program. So she was selected for a program, which is
in a vault.
What's that?
Call the vault program.
Okay.
That's a vault.
Yes.
I've read about that.
All right. So she was selected for the vault program. She was one of a handful of people. It was all guys and her. And it was so top secret that nobody else in the CIA even knew it was happening. And so it was her, the head of the CIA, the president of the United States, the secretary of state. It was like those people knew that was happening. And nobody she worked with knew. And she's just one of these handful of people in this top secret program that was, she was selected before September 11th. And then when September 11th happened, it was essentially sort of the most important thing happening counterterrorism wise. It's kind of probably in the world, wouldn't you say, Trace? I mean, it was like essentially what was, it was essentially being in the center of the response to September 11th. Mm-hmm. And it was just her. And there she was in this, in the vault, which was this top secret room that people didn't even know existed in the CIA. The rest of her, she was dating a guy at the time. She couldn't even tell him what she did. And then it was like, okay, well, see you, buddy. Because he couldn't deal with her having this way higher security clearance. And she's in this vault, in this room, with the president coming in and sitting and chatting with her, the head of the CIA sitting and chatting with her, Condoleezza Rice coming. I mean, she was like the center of what was happening in the United States at the time in response to September 11th. And there she was in the middle of it all and in charge of things that I think we can't even say what she did.
No, you know what? For national security, I'm happy to have, and I'm so grateful for people like you, Tracy, who I don't need to know the ins and outs. Get it, girl. I don't need to know the ins and outs of any special ops because I want to keep us all safe for sure. But how did it all change? Well, how did the world change? How did your job change in terms of everything?
I think, to Jessica's, what she was talking about, when I had first been, I guess, briefed on that, the vault program that I was going to be working on. This was just before September 11th. So like a day or two before, obviously we didn't know it was coming. And I remember saying, you know, might have to kill people with it. Cause I was naive. I think I was like 22. I don't remember exactly how old I was then, but I think I was like 22. And I remember, you know, the guy that was telling me about the program saying, no, not unless there's a big terrorist attack. And so obviously there was. And so I think you almost, everything changed, but you didn't have time at that time to think about what had changed. I know that's not the weirdest thing ever, but it's because everything's moving so fast that you don't have time to sit back and like reflect on what just happened and how all of this just went down because I don't know that that's healthy necessarily, but at the time, you don't have time to like sit back and think about it. But I mean, obviously my life completely changed. Like instead of working during the day, I would work like mostly like nights-ish, kind of like late afternoon to like really early morning. And then I started traveling all the time. And so, yeah, it was a total 180 from that, I guess, 9-to-5 job.
And your traveling included interviewing, I guess, for lack of a better word, terrorists, right? Or terrorist associates?
Yes, yes.
And what was that like?
That was trying to find like the right adjective. So you don't want to say that was great because like you're talking
fun.
Right. Oh, fun. I don't want to also say it was bad because I honestly learned so much. You know,
from what did you learn from it? Yeah, tell us what you learned from.
I would ask them questions. Obviously, I have a list of questions I know I need to ask them for my job. But then sometimes, you know, you have to build up a rapport, right? So you're just like talking to them. And, you know, the one question I learned like so much that was so eye-opening for me was, you know, why did you become a terrorist? Which I know sounds like the most generic question ever.
No, not really.
Well, I don't, it seems basic, right? Like, I guess there's like so many.
But I think people want to know. I mean, it's a very interesting question. Yeah.
It just really changed my perspective because I think as like, you know, this white Jewish, like middle-class sorority girl from California, I always was like, well, these are fanatics. These are crazy people. These are, and that's what I truly thought. But he really, this guy like really changed my opinion. And yeah, Bin Laden is a crazy fanatic. We all know that. But a lot of the people that they recruit to work for them are people that just like can't get their basic needs met in the countries that they're from. Like this guy told me that he was orphaned. He had hepatitis. He was, I mean, we're talking abject poverty in a level that I don't know that even Americans could understand. He had no education, no food, no medicine. Al-Qaeda recruited him, you know, brought him for training, gave him schooling, taught him English, gave him medicine, gave him three meals a day. I don't want to say that makes sense, but like it helped me understand that like a lot of people around the world are not getting their basic needs met by their countries. And that's what they turn to.
Did you find in interviewing these terrorists was beyond that, was there like an anti-American did they feel as though they were in the situation they were in because of our policies and us in general?
So yes and no. Definitely our policies did not help the situation. But one of them was like, oh, I mean, I don't like the Americans, but who I really hate are the Jews. And I'm Jewish. And so I'm like, do I tell you now or do I tell you like never, you know, that I'm Jewish. And so that was obviously eye-opening to me too, that it was like our foreign policy meddling, but also the way that they felt that we supported Israel.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Now, how much danger did you feel that you were in? Or as you said before, you were a little naive to all of it. I'm guessing in the midst of all of it, were you in major danger? Stranger?
Jessica's going to say yes, but I
was. I mean, no.
Yeah, come on, Jessica, tell us how dangerous was it?
I mean, she was in, I can't tell you where she was geographically. She was in a contained space where there are bomb-sniffing dogs, where a dog would sniff a car before she got in it, and then she would have to ride in the trunk just because she's a blonde. Even if she's veiled and covered, you could kind of see the sort of California girl peeking out of there. She would ride in the trunk of a car after the bomb dog sniffed it, wearing a bulletproof vest, and she, you know, in the CIA, you're generally not armed. Am I allowed to say that? Tracy was armed. I don't know if I'm allowed to say, but she,
yeah, if you're in war zones, you are. I think that's pretty.
She was armed, you know, she carried a gun. She wore a bulletproof vest. She had, you know, bomb sniffing dogs. She, you know, I mean, she had like Navy SEALs, these guys that she worked with. She, you know, she was in the middle of a bomb explosion. Once she was in open back helicopters, she was in the worst, the most dangerous, probably the most dangerous places in the world at the time. She was in the place where people were regularly being killed, but she was taking care to try not to get killed by wearing a bulletproof vest and hiding in the trunk of a car. And she was working under an alias. She had nothing on her that had her name. If she had been blown to pieces, nobody would have known it was her. It would have been this alias from some other place that died. I mean, when you talk to her, she doesn't she doesn't think about it as scary because she's working all the, she's like super worker. You know, I mean, even now we'll be on the phone and while we're on the phone, she's doing 15 things and packing her daughter's lunch. You know, I mean, she's like super worker. So she was like working morning to night and not thinking about whether she's going to get killed or not. She was totally fearless.
Was there ever a moment, that's so interesting, Jessica and Tracy, was there ever a moment in your career at the CIA where you felt, okay, this is scary?
I think that there was one country I went to that I do think I was like, had apprehensions about going there. I remember calling my parents and just saying, you know, I'm scared to go here. But I think my naivete and my age in a weird way worked for me because I think, you know, when you're in your early 20s, I don't know about you guys, but like, I felt like I was invincible, which I don't know that that's a good thing, but I think, you know, when you do like really stupid stuff and you think that you're like totally invincible and nothing's going to happen to you. And in a weird way, I think that that totally worked well for me. I wasn't reckless, but like, I don't know that I overthought it to the extent that now in my 40s, I'm like, yeah, that's not going to happen. Like, so part of it is just an age thing. I know that is maybe oversimplifying it, but I felt pretty like invincible.
Well, it also so funny because when I was in my 20s and I was doing reckless things, they had nothing to do with the national security. So I don't know. It's like a different naivete and how those are used in our 20s. Interesting.
I know. Mine was like alcohol, pot, and boys.
Yeah. Totally.
I still liked my alcohol and boys. It doesn't mean I didn't like that.
Never smoked pot. She's never done anything. She's like, so, she's like, out of this, I don't. I mean, I know between me and Sarah, I don't know, but I mean, but she's like so good. She's like way better, but not judgmental at all. She knows all the dumb stuff I've done and has not judged me at all.
But I'm not a judgmental, like all my friends, I'm not, hello, I was in a sorority. Can you imagine the things that I've like seen? Like, I just didn't need it. Like, I was a crazy dancing party animal and like I didn't need like drugs or alcohol. Well, I need alcohol, but like I just wasn't interested. Like, because I just like didn't need it to be crazy. I don't know that that's good or bad.
No, it's, believe me, it's all of the above, you know. I think it's whatever you want to do, but I also think that dealing with what it was that you were dealing with is so much different than what the rest of us in our 20s were tackling. You know, I mean, I was just like, is that like boy cute enough for me? Or, do I live in New York City or Hoboken? Like, no, not quite. Like,
but like, I had those same things too. Like, I don't really have it in my book, but I was totally boy crazy, like, and dated. And like, so, like, I wasn't just like singularly.
She wasn't selfish or self-centered.
I was 20 something. Everyone's like selfish and self-centered when they're 20.
Well, I mean, they were having fun. Like, there's fun stuff. I mean, you're young. Like, I mean, Tracy told me one of my favorite stories about her time in these terrible places is in the middle of the night, one of the Navy SEALs guys came and got her in the middle of the night and was like, let's go have fun. And she's like, okay. And they put on their bulletproof vests and hid in the thing and they drove off and they went to this closed down airport and put on night goggles and got on these ATVs, is that what they're called?
Yeah.
Got on ATVs in night goggles and just flew around this closed down airport in the middle of the night for fun. I mean, in that step, so it's like she was like working her ass off all day, but then she definitely would break loose and have fun. It just wasn't like, you know, me at some bar in San Francisco, like vomiting in the bathroom.
When I was in DC, I hit up all the bars. Like, I did do that.
I love how she's fighting to be like a regular asshole 20-year-old. Like, it's fine. Like, I got you. Okay. All right. You guys, she did. I mean, I know on her awards wall, there is like a prize for like hottest alky at the bar in DC. What was it called? The Tombs?
The Tombs. Oh my God. I love that place.
Yep. That was where you used to hang. We got it.
I hung there all the time.
No. She is a better person than all of us. I'm just saying, I know it.
For sure. And by the way, we're all great people too, but exactly. we certainly weren't, I don't think I've saved a life. So, you know, hardly my own.
You're keeping your dog alive. I mean, that's saying something. What do you see, like 85? Yeah. So one of the most interesting things I thought after reading a little bit more about you was the terrorist chart that you talk about. And how basically you developed this terrorist chart that Colin Powell, you say, used to justify the U.S. invasion of Iraq, but which I think, I'm not quoting you, but you said that they twisted the way that it was titled to make the justification, whereas the chart that you developed or were involved in developing did not point to weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I mean, that's
huge.
Like, can you talk about that a little bit? I mean, I know that, you know, that it's many years now since the Iraq invasion, but I mean, obviously it caused a tremendous amount of death and destruction and changed U.S. policy, you know, forever. So what happened? I mean, what did the terrorist chart say? How were you involved in it? And then
how is it taken out of context?
Yeah.
So I think this is probably Jessica, Jessica, I think you really believe this is like the big plot kind of the book. I think Jessica believes that. And I think I do too. The chart, and it was hard because I was very much like, I'm a liberal, but I was very much for the war in Afghanistan. I make my decisions like based in facts. And so I had seen what happened with September 11th. I was working at the agency. I really supported the mission and like what we were doing there because the evidence supported that. And so I expected, you know, Iraq to not be any different. But it's pretty common, even when you work in operations, like you're dealing with a lot of people and like a lot of different targets. And so to keep them straight, I know this seems really simple, but we would just make these, like, they have these big chart, like printers, I guess, at the agency, and you would put their faces on them, where they were last known, and like their phone number. So you could just like keep them straight, like where they were. And we would like put them up on our like cubicle walls just so we could like keep track of them. And so I worked in the Counterterrorism Center's like weapons of mass destruction group. And we were just looking at Al-Qaeda trying to acquire like biological weapons. And so we had a guy at the top whose name was Zarqawi. And all it said was Al-Qaeda poison chart. That's all our chart said, because that's, I think, what we all believed that it was. And that's what we were using it for. But one day a member of the administration came into our office, which actually is not abnormal. They did that a lot, given like the times. And so they came and one of them looked at the chart and he's like, oh, I want a copy of that chart, which is also not unusual because they briefed the president. We didn't think anything more. But we went ahead and just kind of carried about our business and saw that the chart then was used by Colin Powell and renamed. And you can actually, I did Google it online. You can find it renamed online. And it said like Iraq WMD connect, like Al-Qaeda connections chart. It was completely renamed. And Zarqawi, who was at the top of our chart, we knew he had transited Iraq, but we thought we had no evidence to think he like lived there. It was like a layover, but they used that information to say that he was there and like started up a poison, like WMD cell. And we were pretty pissed, I guess. Not necessarily that it was like misused, but all those guys that we were tracking now know that we're tracking them. And so they go underground. And now we can't find them anymore. And one of them ended up bombing a train in Madrid, Spain, that we felt like we could have stopped. Yeah.
So I just say it was a multi-level betrayal. I mean, first of all, Tracy's job at the time and her team was to, I mean, part of what they were doing everything, but part of it was they were asked to find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And they didn't find them. And they told them, we did not find them. So they, you know, so the CIA never lied to the American public or the government about that. The government twisted their words and lied to the American public. And so it was just, and suddenly the CIA were the bad guys here, you know, like as if they'd given false information, but they never gave false information. They gave the correct information. So not only did this invasion happen and this war start because they twisted the CIA's words, but every person she'd been tracking and looking for suddenly had their face up on the TV screen during Colin Powell's speech to the United Nations? Is that what it was, Tracy?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so suddenly on a speech to the United Nations, all the people who don't know they're being tracked by the CIA and don't know they're being followed and that the CIA has their phone number and knows where they are and is tracking them down, suddenly realizes they're being followed. So it was like this, it was like on so many levels, it was this betrayal.
Was there any follow-up to that? Like, did anything happen to Colin Powell or his...
Colin Powell has written a book. He did write a book about, like, his involvement in the Iraq War. And he actually does admit that the information was misused. But I would say he sort of, like, punts it, which I'm not excusing him, but he basically said, I did not change this chart. Like, someone else changed it for me, which... I have to actually believe. I mean, he was Secretary of State. I don't think he's like photoshopping his own.
Yeah, but ultimately,
you have to fact check it. Yes.
Yeah, and he's. Yes. I mean, you can't always. I don't know. My opinion, when you're in a leadership position like that, I mean, you know, when you're the one in front of the UN presenting the information,
you better know the information.
You didn't photoshop it. Like that's your department. Those are your people. You're the one presenting it to the world with all the repercussions involved. Like. Take responsibility for it. I know very little about the situation other than what we're talking about, but that's what it's.
I totally agree. And that was actually the pushback. I read like an interview that he did about the book. And you're totally right. Like, yes, he did not Photoshop it. I highly doubt he did. But at the same time, if you're going to deliver the information or you have a speech writer writing your speech for you, you better make sure that you're okay with the information that's being put out there as a leader. I think he came under fire for the book when he did that as like not taking responsibility, kind of just what you were saying. He sort of skirted it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were there other instances or examples, which you don't have to flesh out, but other examples of intelligence that you had procured that were taken out of context to perhaps lead people down a different road or twist for their own political purposes? Did you find that in the CIA?
That's a really good question. No, I've never been asked that. No.
Sarah's very proud of herself.
I can only speak from like my lived experience at the agency. Nothing else I did was misused like that. But
sorry, she has a hang up that I ask better questions than she does. It's all
we both ask good questions.
That's where it's coming from. It's all in her head.
You both ask excellent questions.
Thank you.
She's the nicest person ever. I'm so sorry. Please go on. I'm so sorry.
No, in the context of like just my work, I personally cannot think of a time that anything was misused, but I can only speak from my experience. That was the only thing like I observed with my own two eyes.
What was the most challenging part of working for the CIA? Would you say?
That's a good question too.
The last question was better.
we'll grade you at the end.
I'll give you guys like your tens or whatever.
Oh, good.
The most challenging? Oh gosh.
Fighting off all the boys?
No. I think the most challenging was actually having like a stable life, because that starts to like wear on you after a while. Having kind of that crazy life. I just met with someone who was in my book recently. I called Jessica about it because I was like so excited that I got to see him again. But when I had done a talk someplace, he came and surprised me, and it was just really great to see him. But he said he's still with the agency, and he's like, there are some days where I wish that I had done like what you did and had a life now. You cannot do that. I don't know how you could keep a healthy relationship and have kids or have whatever kind of life it is that you want, because it becomes like so wrapped up in work.
Is that why you went to the FBI?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Not because I hated the agency. I loved it. I'm still really good friends with people there. But I just couldn't maintain that like lifestyle anymore. It was too much.
It's pretty unusual to be a special agent like that, going from one agency to the other, right? I mean, is that a pretty rare occurrence?
So that's one thing, Jessica, you'd be very proud. that is one thing that I have found about myself that is unusual. There are no, that I know of at this point, of women who have gone from the offside of the agency to the offside of the FBI. Yay, Jessica.
I know. She just actually said something about it. No, yeah, she's one of the few women who's, well, we don't know any other women who have done this.
Yeah, I can't say other women haven't, because I don't have like access to that information, but I'm trying to find out, but I haven't found any.
And what did you do with the FBI?
So I was a special agent, and I worked in a small office out of the LA field office. And I did Chinese counterintelligence.
Do you have to speak different languages to do these, by the way? Or did you speak any other languages or no?
No. So, well, fun fact about terrorists, the big guys, which are the
we
big guys.
Do a trivia thing after this, like terrorist trivia with Tracy Walder. I love that. It's like a bunch of alliteration. Trivia with Tracy.
The big guys that I talked to, mostly all spoke English, because, I mean, what's really disturbing is a lot of them were educated here in the U.S.
So the ones that Tracy dealt with were the high-ranking Al-Qaeda people. She didn't deal, you know, I mean, people talk about the U.S. government, like, whatever, some guy being held at an airport because he's from someplace and whatever, you know, being harassed. She wasn't dealing with anybody who was even borderline. You know what I mean? Like, she was only dealing with absolute known high-ranking Al-Qaeda people.
So would you say that it's a correct generalization that high-ranking terrorists who run these organizations come from privileged, educated, wealthy families, and that the worker bees, so to speak, below them, who perform a lot of the day-to-day terrorism activities, come from these really poor areas where they have to have their needs met? Is that an accurate generalization?
I think you just hit the nail like right on the head. If you look at like Bin Laden, you know, he was worth $200 million. He's one of the wealthiest families in the Middle East. And like Zawahiri, who's now the head of Al-Qaeda, he is a doctor, a very well respected doctor. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, he was a medical engineer. These are like the high value targets. Saif al-Adel is another one. He's a biochemist. You know, they are all the HVTs, the high value targets. And so all of them have, you know, master's degrees, medical degrees. They may not have come from money, but they acquired money, you know, in the jobs they have. But, you know, I think kind of the lower level folks, they're the ones who aren't having their needs met. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Wow. That's really interesting. I'd heard the other theory, you know, that a lot of terrorists came from, you know, that were recruited from poverty stricken areas, but I had never really thought about the leadership and that they actually come from the elite aspect.
Well, there was a time when they were all in prison together. I don't know, maybe Tracy can say, and I think they tend not to put them in prison together anymore, but there was a time where they were all in prison together and they were recruiting and people, other prisoners. So they had an imprisoned population to proselytize.
Like the ones, the high value guys that I talked to were all not in kind of group situations, I guess, if you will. If on a case, and so I never had to bring a translator with me because they all spoke English. On occasion, I like very rarely, maybe two or three times, had to go and talk to like very low level guys about like something. They were tended, like what Jessica was saying, we're together. And so I'd always have to bring a translator with me for those guys.
Right.
Now I think they're held separately, but no, the high value guys were all definitely separate.
I trained at British and American schools. So back to the FBI, what was that experience like working there?
bad.
As though, you know, from what I researched, there was a lot of misogyny going on.
And I think people, I think that might actually surprise a lot of people, being at such a high level government position, that they're, you know, whether or not there were as many women as there were men, maybe they were still fair and balanced. And that just wasn't the case. Is that?
Yeah. It's funny because Jessica and I, we wrote for that history journal, Jessica, that article. And remember how I was like, whoa, I didn't know that this was such a difference. So the CIA is obviously not perfect. They, I'm sure, have gender issues too. But they've at least acknowledged them and been like trying to deal with them since like the 50s. I did not realize that the FBI did not allow female agents, period. It was against the law until 1972. Like, mm-hmm. I was born in the 70s. Like, that's like not that long ago. And so for me, I think I said to Jessica, I was like, this explains so much, you know, because when you have an agency that's like, 30 years or 25 years, like behind another agency in terms of like gender, like that's going to be ingrained in there. Like, there are people that are still there in leadership positions that worked there probably at a time when there were not allowed to be women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was definitely institutionalized sexism in the FBI that, whether it might have existed in the CIA at one time, but they had been addressing it, creating committees, creating panels, board, like they were constantly, and Tracy uncovered like memos and notices and all these things where they were addressing it and deliberately trying to change, like saying, let's hire women, let's bring women in here, let's, and there's a woman running the CIA today. Mm-hmm. The head of the CIA is a woman. It was almost the opposite. And when Tracy was there, I mean, it's so amazing because the stories she told me were just unbelievable. Like, you cannot get over how sexist they were. And in the middle of her trying to write, you know, the two of us working on this book and her telling me all these stories and all these things happened. In the middle of this, a group of women brought a lawsuit against the FBI and contacted Tracy, like, while we were discussing this. Because, and they were suing the FBI for exactly the kinds of things that she went through, which was like the most discrimination, but also like from people who seem like morons, like telling her suit is too tight. And it was disturbing to them because what? Because they got a boner or something. Like, so she's in charge of their boners and has to wear a baggy suit. I mean, so yeah. Essentially she had to dress like David Byrne in Talking Heads. Everybody. Pants caught in the FBI. I mean, it was ludicrous.
Yeah. Well, it's a typical example of men sort of using, you know, women, you know, naming us as the distraction and like the cause of their downfall. It's like from ancient times up until today. It's like, it's right. Your fault that I'm getting turned on by you, you know, like, yeah, and therefore I can't do my fault. Work.
Yeah. Garden of Eden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. So, yeah, so while we were like in the middle of going through this, he's getting messages from the New York Times and from people who are, and I think that lawsuit is still ongoing, right?
Yep. It's 17 women and it's with the FBI. It's crazy. And I think I was so upset because I thought like I should have done more, you know, like when I left. Or I was also upset too because I really thought that, I don't know. I was like, this is 20. I think it was like 2018 when I first had heard about that lawsuit. I was like, this is 2018. Like, why is this, how is this still going on? Like, this is, and it's going on and even on a larger scale. It was just crazy.
So what do you feel like, sorry, were you going to ask something, Sarah?
I was just going to ask, what exactly were you working on when you were in the FBI? How long were you there? And I mean, I can imagine why you did leave if this had something to do with it, but if you could just, you know.
Yeah. So I kept thinking that it would get better after the Academy, after Quantico. So I stayed at, you know, my mom and several other people are like, you should have just left. Like, that was so bad. But I just kept thinking it'll change. So I was sent to that office and I worked a case of these Chinese nationals but became American citizens who were stealing our nuclear submarine cloaking technology.
I'm so sick of dealing with this cloaking technology.
But it was kind of like fun because it was my first year there. And so when it's your first year, you have like this checklist of things you have to do. And so like I got to go out with other squads on like gang arrests and like those kinds of things too were really, I don't want to say fun, but it was interesting to like get a feel for like what everyone did. But no, I did leave because I couldn't deal with the harassment anymore.
And then you went on to get your master's in education and became a history teacher, which seems like came full circle. That was your
original goal. Yes.
Yeah. And so you teach at an all-girls school, right? Is it a high school?
I left in January, though.
Okay. And so how is that? Is it everything you dreamed of? Was it everything you dreamed of? And are you glad you made that decision?
Oh, yeah. I don't have any regrets. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I wish that things were a little different at the FBI because I thought that when my book came out and people from FBI read it, that I'd get all this kind of like hate stuff from them. And it's actually been the opposite. A lot of really high up like agents in charge of some offices have reached out and like said, you know, I wish that, you know, I got to work with you so that you didn't have, and so it would have been interesting to see how like that panned out if I wasn't just like, I guess in the luck of the draw environment that I was in, but I don't have any regrets about becoming a teacher at all.
Yeah. Yeah. And how
did you two get together? How did the Jessica Blau and the Tracy Walder meet and create together?
I guess the agent sent Tracy, I forget, you told me recently how many people they sent you to look through, like
40 something. I don't remember.
Yeah, it was amazing, an amazing number. And so she ended up, I guess, talking to some of them on the phone. I don't know how many you talked to on the phone.
I had narrowed down to 8 on the phone.
Okay, so she talked to 8 on the phone. So I happened to be in Southern California with my family at the Bee, and I was on book tour. That's right. And I was in Southern California, and she was in Southern California visiting her family, and we had this phone call. And, you know, it's sort of like a blind date. You're trying to think, like, do I want to spend time? Because writing a book, working with somebody on their book is, like, super intimate. Like, you're really close. And if you don't like them, it's the worst experience in the world. It's like marrying somebody you hate. So, you know, you have to have the right person. So we're on the phone, and I'm talking to her. So first I'm Googling her, and this picture of her came up with this, holding this semi-automatic rifle. And smiling, and she's just like gorgeous and badass. And I was just like, I want to be gorgeous and badass. I'm looking at this picture thinking, oh my God, that's who I want to be. And, you know, and I'm all for gun control. I really am. But there's something incredibly just amazing.
I don't own a gun. So.
This woman with this semi-automatic weapon. And then I'm talking to her and it's like, oh, we're both from Southern California and we're both Jewish. Okay, she's like a good person and I'm like a, you know, like an idiot. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I was the dumbass idiot surfer chick, you know, vomiting in bar bathrooms, and she was not. But, you know, whatever. But,
yeah, I always say accomplished authors are idiots too. That makes total sense to me.
No, but she was just so admirable and interesting, and we're a lot, and we're both Jewish, and it was just like, and so I'm talking to her thinking, oh, okay, you're the person I want to be. Like, how much fun to hang out with the person I want to be.
I felt the opposite about Jessica, was that she was just like so, I wanted to be her because she was so creative. Mm-hmm. And she was so free and like kind. And I had read The Trouble with Lexi. Mm-hmm. I think that you had sent that to me. And I was like, she's so freaking talented. Like, how would this woman even want to work with me? I was worried that you wouldn't want to work with me because I thought you were so talented and so beautiful. It's funny that we had the same reaction.
And it's like, then we get to know each other. It's like, oh my God, she's even better in person. And we have fun together and we crack up. And
it's like family now.
Yeah, I mean, no, totally family. Like, now it's a relationship for life. It's like,
What's the process like? I mean, do you just, you sit down together and do you have prepared questions, Jessica? And she talks and then you sort of like scribe. I mean, I'm just curious what the process is like.
Well, we work on Google Doc. Well, so Tracy would talk, but the thing about her is she doesn't have a sense of where to, she would talk. I mean, obviously she's unbelievably intelligent and all that stuff, but she doesn't have a sense of her own story or drama. So she would be talking and she would skim over something. She's like, well, that was when the bomb blew up. And then I, you know, and she'd go on and I'd be like, okay, we're just going to back
that. We're going to unpack that. Yeah.
Yeah. And now we're going to talk about the bomb. You know, so it'd be stuff like.
It's funny.
We would use like a Google Doc and then like we'd figure out, I think we ended up doing it more like locationally, like the chapters. And so I would just write like everything I could possibly remember about like what happened in that situation. And then I would tell her that it was like done. And then she'd go in there and have all these questions, like elaborating, like, because I would skip over details, I guess.
Right. And what prompted you to write the book in the first place?
Well, I don't want to like alienate your listeners, but I feel like it'll be okay. the election.
Yeah.
I was mad. I was super mad. And, you know, I'd been out for a while. My husband was always like, write a book, write a book, write a book. And no, 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 no. And then Trump won. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I've had it. Yeah.
You won't alienate any of our listeners, by the way. Because, we're pretty vocal about the orange man in the room. So, yeah.
Are you still... Go ahead.
Sarah. Oh, I was just wondering how long did it take for you guys to collaborate on it, and how did it get in the hands of Ellen Pompeo?
Well, we're both like, we both hate having stuff hanging over our heads. So we work like, I mean, we called her writing, her word vomit. She would just like pour it out and everything went back and forth. So it really was a true, absolute collaboration. It went back and forth. And so, but we're both hyper. We're both big workers, and so we actually wrote, everything happened ahead of schedule. It was all ahead of schedule.
We were super quick.
Super productive and quick, and we have, we have a literary agent, we have a Hollywood agent, and the Hollywood agent sent it out, and three people were trying to get a hold of it to bid on it, and Ellen Pompeo's company took it.
And what are they going to do with it?
Hollywood is so bizarro that it's almost like, it's kind of like talking about a pregnancy when you're just having tons of sex. So essentially,
we're having
sex with Hollywood right now.
Well, I have to say, I've never heard of a more perfect story for Hollywood. I mean, you know, TV, movie, whatever it is. I think it's, you know, definitely something people will. Because you know, what really people are so, I think, interested in is that, you know, you seem so normal and down to earth and girl next door. And also, I hate to keep bringing, you know, beauty into it. Yes, you're beautiful and all of that stuff. But then you have these things that you've done that all of us feel like there's no way we could ever do that. And so those two things combined, I think, really draw people in. And even subliminally, we think, oh, I wonder if I could have done that or I could do that, you know?
I think you can.
Yeah.
Part of what I fear, or I guess I worry about, is like, I don't know how old you guys are, but I know Jessica and I existed like before, like when I was in college and high school, or, you know, formative years or whatever. It was before all of these like Criminal Minds and Homeland and Quantico. Like I didn't have any of that growing up. At all. Like, we didn't even have the new James Bonds, like with Pierce Brosnan or whatever his name is. Like, none of that was it. So it wasn't like glamorized, right? And so I had like no picture of what I did at the CIA. I think maybe the problem now sometimes is people think they can't do it because they see like these impossible things.
Like,
like Homeland or The Bourne Identity or, you know, all of those things, which like obviously it could not be further from the truth. But, you know, people believe that as like, oh, that's what it must be. And so I think I was lucky in that I didn't have any of those references at all. And so I didn't think I had to like live up to something or that I couldn't do it because there was nothing to compare it to.
Yeah.
At least for me.
Right. And I do think when we've done these interviews with people and just talking to people in my, you know, day-to-day life, what's becoming more clear to me is that no matter what you do, even if it appears glamorous or not, it's hard work. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's hardworking people who put in the day-to-day effort and are smart about it, and a little bit of luck. But even if it's that we just interviewed a woman who was a high fashion model and is now a modeling agent, and she's a really hard worker, you know, and a lot of these models are really hard workers. And just like you, you know, they go to work day to day and they put in the hours and they do their best. And sometimes it's really long hours and they get tired of it. And then they move on because they want the stability because they're human just like the rest of us. So, but I love the sort of the juxtaposition of both of those, you know, sort of the glamour side and then the.
I love the high stakes of your job, especially in terms of the gender roles. You know, I think it's so often, and as was evidenced to you, especially in the FBI, that it's so often men who do it. And so not only is the book female driven, but it was authored by two hot, cool, badass bitches who wanted to be each other, which is very reminiscent of the work I do with Katie. So,
very similar paths, yeah.
It's a similar high stakes.
Except for the hard work part, yeah.
How dare you?
I'm just kidding. We're super.
But I have a semi-automatic in my apartment. But on that note,
it's dog sized. Wait, I have a quick question though, real quick before you, if you end, oh, we have to find out your obsession.
Right, that was what I was going to ask.
Okay, but real quick before you do that, I want to know, Jessica or Tracy, I guess mostly Tracy, who do you want to play you?
Oh, God.
You can say me, Tracy. It's fine. It's
fine. Sarah.
Thank you.
Sarah.
Oh!
I was on Grey's Anatomy, so it just would be the most seamless.
It would be an easy transition.
Jessica, who do you think should play her?
You know who I want? Did you see Ozark?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. We just had my obsession last week.
Yep.
Wait, who? Laura Linney?
No.
Oh, Julia Garner.
Julia Garner.
Julia Garner.
I love her so much. She's so talented, and she's bad, and she's Jewish, and she's badass, and she's blonde. Like, you just straighten her hair, and, like, there's Tracy.
Oh, my God. I'm obsessed.
I love her so much. I loved her in The Americans. Did you see The Americans?
Oh, I never watched that show.
She's unbelievable in The Americans. She's unbelievable in Ozark. She's, like, she's just this power. She is in acting with Tracy was in the CIA, and it's like, if God, she would be the dream. She's amazing.
Part of my problem is, like, I don't watch hardly any movies or TV or any. Well, I watch TV, but not the good kind.
What do you watch? Okay, we don't have to go there.
I watch Real Housewives of everything.
Yes. Oh my God, are you kidding me?
What are you kind of obsessed with right now?
Please don't judge me.
Oh my God, I live for it. I are you kidding? We did it live last night and people were typing in, we'd love to stay, but we have to go watch The Real Housewives of New York. So I love it. I get it. Dorinda is very angry this season.
Definitely.
Thank you.
100%.
Thank you, Tracy. What, Jessica, what are you obsessed with right now?
Oh, well, you know, I'm in lockdown, so I'll tell you one thing I'm obsessed
Why?
With.
What are you talking about? What's going on over there?
So one thing is like my nails, like I hate the whole nail thing. So I was, one of my daughters, I was talking to her on FaceTime and she had these gorgeous nails. And I'm like, what?
How'd she get them done?
Well, I'm like, what the fuck? She's like, I just bought press-on nails.
Nice.
Great. So I bought press-on nails. And they look good, but the thing is they keep falling off, and so I'm always worried I'm going to, like, eat one or fall over it and it's gonna stab me in the eye. So
they look good, though.
They look good.
Amazing. Well, especially that one.
You don't know where they are. It's like, so I just feel like I was with my building manager the other day. We were looking at some air conditioners, and I thought, I probably was, like, gesticulating, and, like, a nail flew off and was, like, his chocolate or something. Like, I'm like, where are these things that are falling off? So I'm obsessed with the hideousness and my press-on nails, which feel very Real Housewifian.
That's so hysterical. You know, for my senior prom, the person who introduced me and Jessica was my prom date, and I specifically had red press-on nails. So that's very miracle that you are flipping wearing them.
I've never done it in my life. It's a first. It's a new COVID.
it might go post. Anything else, Jess?
That I'm obsessed with? Oh, I've been watching Mary Tyler Moore in reruns. I've been obsessed with that.
That's like, amazing.
I love Mary Tyler Moore. She's in a studio apartment, and for some reason this thrills me because I'm locked in one in the middle of New York City. So I love that Mary's in one.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. So
where are you, or is that on Netflix? Where are you finding it?
It's on Hulu. You can watch it from season one, episode one.
That's amazing.
Right. It totally held up.
Hmm. Tracy, what are you kind of obsessed with these days?
Currently my eyebrows, because I can't get them done. And I am obsessed with having my eyebrows like groomed, and like groomed well. And it's like one thing I cannot do it myself. And waxing facilities here in Texas have reopened, but I just can't bring myself to go. So every day I like look for stray hairs 24/7.
Oh my God. By the way, it makes me love you more to know that those things are at your fingertips and are open, and yet you are not going and utilizing these businesses at the moment. But that's why I'm wearing glasses. I used to be obsessed with my eyebrows. I refuse to touch them anymore. They are ridiculous. It's just stupid.
Yeah.
Eyebrows are a thing. Like it seems like a small thing, but apparently they do really shape your face and make a big difference.
Look, you have nice eyebrows, Katie.
Me?
Yes.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. You both have nice eyebrows too. I was going to say they're very well. Even see, the nice thing about Zoom and not being in real life is that even though we can't, you know, get anything waxed, like we can't really see it anyway. Like it's it's like that stuff is not that clear. So. Yeah.
But you can like totally see it on yourself, and then it makes you obsessed.
That's the problem.
Exactly.
The problem is that I have a mirror, and it's like to be alone and locked down is to spend way too much time in front of a mirror. And it's like nobody should look at themselves that closely ever. And usually I'm just way too busy to glance at myself. And it's like I have entire evenings open where I can just look at myself. I mean, it's a horrible, horrible pastime. I should just get rid of all the mirrors in the house and stuff.
Well, Jessica, luckily for you, you're a hot woman. It's a fact. You also happen to be super bright and amazing, and both of you are so stunningly accomplished. I think I speak for both of the kind of obsessed hosts when I say this was so much fun, even with all of Jessica's freezing. I am so excited to see your book come to life, Tracy. And what's next for you? You're not teaching anymore.
So I'm actually going to be teaching next year at college. I'll be adjunct professor there. I'm really excited.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Are you guys touring now for the book? Are you still doing that or?
Doing what? Publicity?
You're like going on tours for the book and. Well, of course not anymore. Yeah. Sorry.
Well, I'm doing a lot of virtual stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what Katie meant when she asked that
question. That's what I meant. Yes. Sorry.
Well, it was, I mean, you know, Tracy was like, I mean, Good Morning America had her on, and she, neither of us are Fox watchers, but they appreciated the book, and they had her. I mean, there was so much stuff booked that got canceled. It was a little painful.
Yeah.
You did get
I saw the big Times Square Good Morning America neon light. That's pretty, I mean, that's huge, Tracy.
That's the one that got that picture. You got that picture. That was like the best picture.
It was great. Yeah. I mean, everybody who reads it loves her, and it's just like suddenly everything shut down. It's a little hard, but Tracy's still getting on blogs and newspapers.
Doing what I can do.
Yeah.
Well, we're so happy to have you. Jessica, what are you working on now? Can you tell us?
I've got two novels that I'm working on, and I just FaceTimed with my editor night before last, which was kind of, you know, that was our meeting, and I'm just working, trying.
Still having sex, Sarah. I'm trying to get pregnant, so don't ask any more questions. Right? Isn't that the comparison?
Yeah. Well, that's the Hollywood comparison.
Well, she doesn't want to tell us all of her stuff.
Oh my God. I'm not having any sex. Let's not talk about it. Jessica!
What did she say?
She said, oh, you're not? Oh, this one's getting around. I'm sorry.
I'm not.
No, I don't mean getting around. Sorry, I didn't mean to make it sound like you're doing the rounds of New York City on lockdown. But no, I'm not having sex.
No.
Oh my God. Okay. This is totally being cut out. But,
really, really fun. This was like, seriously, I love talking to you guys and finding out about your stories. And, you guys seem like you have a really great, relationship. And I mean, it seems pretty clear that that will, you know, plays into the book and makes it a really great book. So, and congratulations on writing the book. I mean, what an accomplishment.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
Thank you. You guys are great. I subscribe. You crack me up.
I subscribe now too. I did it 2 days ago.
But I like the variety that you can, that you go from, like, you're not pinholed into any kind of person.
Well, yeah. I appreciate that. And I would like to also say that Tracy, once all of this is over, get your booty to New York and the four of us will have many.
Oh my gosh. That's really the first place I want to go. So.
Yay. Well, thank you guys so much. I know you all are busy.
Mwah. Mwah. Take care.
Bye. Bye. Bye.